Good morning, and the conversation begins here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon, and a rainy WIP day it promises to be. So no matter where you go, stay dry and stay with us. Always good conversation. When we come back in just a bit, we're going to be talking with an expert on whether you can leave your child home and some of the things that can go wrong when we're having a child. All this and more as we talk with expert Diane Redleaf in just a bit. My name's Peter Solomon, the WIP time, 6:02. It's Conversation. My name's Peter Solomon. It's 94 WIP. And with me this morning for Conversation, attorney at law, child advocate, family advocate, Diane Redleaf. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning. Nice to be with you.
Thank you. Thank you for getting up real early to talk to me.
It is a little early.
Yes, it is. All right. Now, Diane, your new book, Home Alone.
No, it's not Home Alone.
Okay,
it's,
no, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I'm talking about Home Alone,
They took the kids last night, how the child protection system puts families at risk. What's the basic thesis behind that title?
I'm sorry, what's the basic
thesis?
The basic thesis is that our system of justice for families is presumes guilt. It makes it extremely hard for families to get a fair shot at even proving their innocence. We have a system that kind of stacks the deck in favor of parents being guilty until proven innocent, instead of the opposite.
Innocent until proven guilty is certainly a foundation of the American justice system.
Exactly, but not when it comes to the child protection system.
Well, but when it comes to the child protection system, it's in some cases, and maybe too many cases, it's a question of keeping a child safe and alive, isn't it?
Well, that's what it's supposed to be. But we have a system that will take anything that happens to a child, anything that looks a little bit suspicious, anything that maybe we don't really know what the underlying facts really are, the system will very often, and in Philadelphia this is especially true, will assume that the child was deliberately hurt by the parents, or that they need to be protected first, and then we'll figure it out.
Okay. And is that where the Home Alone piece comes in? Because often I'm told leaving a child home alone is a first step in terms of getting a child into child welfare, because people find out he's alone and go, oh, my God, he's going to die.
That's it. That's one of the kinds of typical cases that happens, and it's happening very frequently these days. I'm in Chicago, and in our area there was a case that made the news, I think nationally, about an 8-year-old who walked her dog around the block and had a hotline call made. Now, the child wasn't taken from the parents, but it was a very traumatic experience to be questioned by authorities and to, have to go through a detailed investigation over something as simple as that, walking your dog.
What was the complaint, though, about child walking the dog? I've sent my kids out with the dog.
Well, there was one, because she was home. She was alone walking her dog outside. We often don't see kids outside anymore because of this fear of stranger danger and the fact that people can make hotline calls and kids, are playing outside a whole lot less. And now I'm working to change that so that we can have children can be safe as well as able to play at the same time. I mean, it shouldn't be too hard, but we have a system where we have laws that encourage hotline calling based on very little information. Like, there's what I would call when in doubt call.
All right. Which maybe isn't such a bad thing, though, because It protects a child, and doesn't that put the burden on the person picking up the phone to say, hey, I'm going to check this out?
Well, it's a noble impulse to think that you, you know, should be caring about a child who might be in danger. The problem is, I think, with the next step, which is, who are we trusting? What are we expecting? And what is the tool that we have to address that situation? Because once the call gets made, it needs to get sorted out. It needs to be handled. It needs to be investigated. And who are we deferring that to? And a completely overworked bureaucracy that keeps getting bigger and bigger, but also doesn't have the resources to really figure it out. So in America, the most recent statistics are there were 7.4 million children called to hotlines in America. And that's one-tenth of, if it were separate children, and probably it isn't, probably some kids are subject to multiple calls, but there's 70 million plus, a little bit over 70 million kids in America. So that's 10%. So it's a huge number.
Absolutely, it's a huge number. And there's too few social workers to investigate, isn't there?
Right, and so the investigation by itself, just imagine, you know, an 8-year-old girl, a 6-year-old boy, a 4-year-old, you know, questioned by somebody about what's going on in their home. Oftentimes, if the child really is seriously abused, they're not going to talk. So it's but if they aren't, they're going to be, you know, fearful too, oftentimes, you know, not know what to say, very upset by the experience of being questioned. And they very often are questioned. They're sometimes pulled from school. So I think we need to screen this out better. I think we need to have a clearer idea that that this is really for the serious cases. This is for the serious cases. Now, my book does talk about serious cases, but it goes into the details of how accidents and medical conditions can get confused, you know, and the system can get it wrong, and then it becomes very, very challenging for the parents.
A lot of us, though, Diane, get our notion about such systems from TV. As you were talking, I thought about Law and Order Special Victims Unit as one example. And there are a lot of very seriously injured children portrayed on that show. Or the movie Home Alone. I mean, 30 years old, but it's still a relevant issue.
Yeah, well, that kid was allowed to be alone. And he did okay. He managed, right? No, it's not something that you would, you know, say, recommend. You know, we don't recommend that people leave their kids home alone and see how they manage, you know, in the face of that. But I think you're right, though, that the media culture encourages a lot of misunderstanding and a lot of ideas of, you know, what is happening to kids. We have a problem that, you know, people will think, if you think about injured children, you imagine the worst, and the media portrays the worst. So we think of that as the common situation, and it's not. It's extremely uncommon. Most of the cases that are called to hotlines are concerning neglect. There can be serious neglect. It can be, but it can also range. It can be a 4-minute, somebody left the child in the car to run in and get a bottle of some milk. I mean, that gets called in. That was the most common case I handled as a lawyer for families. You know, that the running into the store for milk.
Well, that's extraordinary, because leaving the kid in the car while you're running for milk is not child abuse as much as it is poor judgment.
Well, but people, for many years, that would be considered to be perfectly okay. And in fact, statistics show that the child is least safe when driving with the parent rather than in the car sitting waiting for the parent. So one study said, you know, if you wanted your child to be kidnapped, just hypothetically, and you decided you were going to leave your child in the car and see if the child would be kidnapped, it would take 500,000 years statistically for that to happen, because that's the rate of kidnapping of kids from sitting in cars. So, but we have, you know, our thought processes about this are, we are imagining, constantly imagining the horror story, you know, of what could happen to this kid in the car, even if their mother's gone for 4 minutes.
And I think you raise an important question for us to talk about for a minute, and that's what was okay then is not okay now. Societal expectations about what's okay change, don't they?
Yes. I mean, a woman named Kim Brooks has written a very good book called Small Animals, and she really just talks about the anxiety that parents now feel, and especially mothers, and the idea that mothers are supposed to keep their eyes on their child 24 hours a day, otherwise they're at fault. And it's interesting that this does not happen very often to fathers when they are, you know, when they are the ones leaving the kid in the car. They may not be the ones as often, but when they are the ones, they tend to be let off, or there's not even a call. Mm. People assume that, you know, if the father's doing it, he has a reason, he has a good reason. But mothers get clobbered with this.
And you're listening to Conversation here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning, Diane Redleaf, her new book about children in the child protective service system and how the system doesn't always do the best for these children, in her opinion. And we have a caller this morning, Diane. So let's say good morning to Stefan. Good morning, Stefan. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. How you doing today? I listen to you a lot in the morning, and I love your, whatever you have on radio, I love everything that you do. But I want to talk to a young lady about child advocate, okay? I know a case where the neighbor did not like the young lady that the kids was with, okay? Did not like, they had a beef. And what happened, she called DHS, and they came out and took that lady's kid. How can y'all take people's kids that somebody call and make a false statement, and y'all come out, oh, it's something wrong? That's, to me, that's wrong. How can you take somebody's child that this woman worked hard to give up roof, food, and everything, and y'all just come up there and take their kids and put them in a bad situation, and something happened to them? And that's what happened to this young lady. They took her kids, her daughters, gave them to somebody else, and something happened. Now, so you tell me, explain that to me, that accuser, if somebody accused me, I should have the right to see who accused me. But y'all, DHS, tell us or whoever and say, oh, no, we can't let you know who made the complaint. Why is that?
Well, that's exactly what I'm talking about. That's a common scenario, too common, that a complaint, we may not even be very well grounded, comes through a hotline, gets assigned to somebody who doesn't really do a thorough investigation, and children, and the remedy, the tool that they have, is to take the child and put them somewhere else. And that poor mother then has to get a lawyer, fight for her child, and is basically presumed guilty on the say-so of a neighbor who doesn't like her.
Right. So my thing is, I don't have no children. But if I'm a man, I'm a grown man, I'm 50-something years old, I work every day. I'm not going, if I had children and y'all came to my door and take mine, it would be a problem. You know what I mean? I would not let nobody take my children from me. I don't care who they are. You know, the law is so backwards. The law that we can hurt your children, but we can't discipline out. That's what the problem is. We're not allowed to discipline our children. That's why the problem out here in the streets today is going on. You know what I mean? It's okay for the cops to beat them, but y'all can't beat them, but it's okay for the law to beat them. My mother always told me when she disciplined me back in the day, she said, I'd rather me to beat you than the cops to beat you. Because when I beat you, after I'm finished, I'm going to say I love you. And I learned the hard way. Don't trust me. I was beaten with honor cords and everything. And it made me a great man. I never was arrested. I have a good career. I have a beautiful home. I have a good job. It didn't hurt me. It made me a better man. Today, oh, know why these kids the way they are today? Because you can't discipline them. Oh, but the children can beat the parents. Come on. Something wrong with this system. But I'll be darned, I'm going to let a child beat me. And I'll be darned, I'm going to let a child that I feed get up 4 o'clock in the morning to get out here and work hard for to take care of them, for the system to take them and put them in a bad situation.
Well, you've got the system pretty clear. I would say that's a common situation. And yes, we have an idea that basically the children can do no wrong, and the parents, I've had a number of cases where the parent absolutely was defending themselves from being attacked by the child, and it was the parent who got clobbered with a child protection case.
Yes, that's wrong. And that can mess up your whole life of a parent. It can mess you up getting a job. It can mess you up getting anything that you want in life, because the system that they just have, because I have a niece that worked for them, that all they do is come in, and half of them don't even have kids. Half of them, they just don't
even
have
kids. Well, and a lot of them are young, and as I said, overworked.
And they're young. There you go. And they're young and don't have no kids. Do you have kids? No. So how are you going to tell me how to take care of mine? I am a black man. To understand a black child, you have to be black. Because sitting here, time out, it don't work for black children. You can watch the news and see that it don't work, okay? Know how it works for us men to be men. We are the black men are the foundation of our kids. What's happening is the system is breaking down, allowing the black man, that's the heart and the root of the building, is being crushed. And y'all think, we crush the black man, the black woman is easy to be crushed. No, not with mine. Because if I had kids, there's no way in the world I'm going to let this happen to mine. Because DHS couldn't come to my house. It's about something. Oh, we're taking your kids. Oh, no, you're not. No, you're not.
I'm not recommending that if they come out, you approach it the way you're suggesting. Because that will escalate the situation, just like with the police, right?
Very often they come with police.
Hello?
Very often they come with police, Stephen.
They do often come with police.
Yes, they do. Right. But that's wrong. Because now you sitting there, they telling you to get out your way. They barge in your house. And that is not right, man. But it's not right. It's not right.
Well, unfortunately, our laws have allowed all of this. I want to bring it back to why is this happening? And I bring it back to... And especially in the state of Pennsylvania, there has been a series of expanding the hotline, the laws that bring the cases to the attention of the authorities. There's been a massive increase in the number of kids that are coming to the hotline and being taken. And in Philadelphia is a national leader in removing children.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you, Stephen. I appreciate it. Bye.
Bye-bye.
And you're listening to 94 WIP Conversation, our conversation on child welfare with author Diane Redleaf. My name's Peter Solomon. Diane, 2 children, same situation, same age, same everything, except one is Caucasian and one is not. Which child, if either of them, is likely to be taken?
It's not as simple as that. You can't say one will be taken and one won't. The rates are significantly higher for the African American child, but also the presenting issue might be different too. So if you're saying the exact same thing happened, there can be a lot of disparity. Shockingly to me, African-American children are being taken from their parents for parents using marijuana. Never happens with a white. I've never seen that happen with a white Caucasian family. So there is, you know, a much more punitive response with the Caucasian families. On the other hand, I think the dog walking case might not happen in a, you know, as much in an African American family because, you know, they're sort of a, well, you know, we don't necessarily assume that child doesn't know how to handle the situation, or we may make a bunch of assumptions about, you know, that child. Or another kind of observation that I've had, I haven't seen any research on this, but it seemed to me that we take domestic violence situations that involve white Caucasian women and we'll say, she should have left that situation, and so we're going to blame her for not leaving the situation, and we're going to take her kids and sometimes put them with the abusive families. I've not seen that happen to an African-American family, and maybe it's because, you know, there's just the calls don't get made, you know, over, you know, there's so much fear of calling the police about domestic violence in the African-American community that happens, so there'd be less removals. So you can't necessarily say one child would be taken and one wouldn't, but definitely overall there's a substantial disproportionality and many more kids getting taken. I actually had a Philadelphia statistic. In Philadelphia, 68% of the kids in the foster care system are African American, and 52% of the children are African American. So you can see that significantly higher percentage of the kids are African American.
And when kids are taken, very often they're placed with foster families, and the foster family system is, I think, also inadequately staffed and funded, and the people are not always the best, are they?
Well, sometimes they are and sometimes they're not. I mean, sometimes they're saving, you know, the lives of the kids that they're caring for, and sometimes they're more abusive than the home that the parents, that the children came from. And it's also just can be a very unstable situation for a child. You know your parent is going to stick, as the caller just said, the parent's going to stick with you and fight for you as a parent and, you know, make some mistakes, but really love the child, you know, really be dedicated and care for the child. That is not what you necessarily get when you place a child with a foster parent.
Or in an institution for children.
Or an institution for children, exactly right.
All right, we have another caller, Diane Redleaf. Let's say good morning to Hannibal from North Philadelphia. Hannibal, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Have there been any research concerning the destruction of the black family when it deals with DHS taking the child out of the family because of, you know, whatever reason it is?
Oh, absolutely.
And pitting it in white families. And the
child growing up
with a cultural complex because of growing up in a white family as opposed to a black family.
Unfortunately, you know, there's been a big movement, and through the 1990s, we saw this, to eliminate racial preferences so that, you know, I guess the feeling was, you know, it was hard for white families to get children, and they were, you know, there were these preferences that were being followed. And so there was a law that actually was passed to try to stop that, from stop the state from putting kids with same race families. Now, at the same time, there is a preference usually for relatives, so that is some help in trying to make sure that kids, you know, get placed with people who are, you know, culturally familiar. Another issue related to this is placing kids in a home that speaks the same language. For some years, I'm in Chicago, so I worked on a lawsuit to stop the state from taking children from Spanish-speaking homes and putting them in non-Spanish-speaking homes, because if that goes on long enough, the kids will lose their ability to communicate with their parents, you know, if they're not exposed to their language. So these are all, you know, major issues in the child welfare system, and it's definitely, you know, a fight over, you know, putting kids in the Native American community. It's an incredibly important issue.
What's the aim and objective of DHS or the welfare system in doing something like that?
Well, I think it's not necessarily out of malice or out of an intention to put a kid into an unfamiliar situation. It's the available homes that they have recruited. That is the primary reason. I mean, in the case of Spanish, I mean, they hadn't recruited enough Spanish-speaking foster homes, and they didn't have enough Spanish-speaking workers to, you know, make the decisions. And sometimes it can be a real challenge because, I mean, I recall having one case a long time ago where the family spoke an unusual dialect. It wasn't Spanish. They were from Mexico, but they didn't speak Spanish. And so just the challenge of communicating with that family was great. And, you know, when you add to the, you know, the caseload problems, the need to recruit, to have families, and there is a shortage oftentimes of families who are willing to take in foster kids. So not so much in the African-American community. I mean, they really, you know, the African-American community, in my experience, has really stepped up to take kids in need and to make sure that they, you know, to the extent they can, of course. But, you know, it's much more likely that they'll take in a relative child, I think, than a Caucasian might, which is a gross generalization. I probably should stop there.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Hannibal. And again, we're listening to Conversation here on 94 WIP All Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning, Diane Redleaf, expert on the child welfare system and what she sees as some of the abuses that it perpetrates. I come back, though, Diane, better to make, they say it in criminal cases more than these, better to let one guilty man go free than to put 100 innocent people in jail. Better to let a child be safe than to be dead. What do you think?
Well, you flipped it, right?
Oh, yeah, I think so.
Yeah, you think that should we be rounding up all the kids who might be in danger some of the time a little bit and then take them from their parents and then put them where? I mean, that's kind of almost the system we have.
Well, all right, Diane, I just anointed you head of Health and Human Services, and you get to fix the foster care system and the child welfare system any way you want. How would you begin?
I would do a lot of what actually I think the federal government is beginning to start to try to do, and that is focus on primary prevention, right? That since the cases that are coming in are really not what you think, they're not necessarily, you know, a beaten and starved child deliberately. That is not the usual case. It's the parent who's struggling to pay the rent. It's the mother who's doesn't have child care. It might be substance abuse. And yes, that can range from, you know, being a problem that the parent, you know, always makes provision for the child, but still has a substance issue. That can range from that to, you know, really not being able to care for the child. But so we have to look at the underlying reasons that the kids are coming into the system, and they're mostly poverty. They're mostly lack of sufficient resources. And when you deal with those resource issues, then you start to be able to really give kids a better chance. I mean, give kids a better chance to have a healthy childhood.
What you're really talking about is making these children a national priority, which they are not today.
Well, I think we're so hung up on blaming parents and disparaging parents that we're not really helping parents. It's a challenge to raise kids.
Oh, absolutely. And along with my wife, we raised two of them at home. And I will confess there were times I wanted to smack them silly, but I didn't. And I think every parent can identify with that feeling, certainly.
Yeah, no, it's you know, and parents can make mistakes, but mistakes shouldn't, unless they're really life-threatening to the child and deliberate, really, in my view. And not just my view. I mean, that's really what the Constitution says. The Constitution as interpreted by the courts that have been asked to interpret it, they really say you need a risk of serious injury to the child and a imminent emergency reason to take a child away.
All right. Now, you also, though, talk about medical mistakes and how they influence this process. Could you talk more about that, please?
Oh, yes. Yes. I mean, my book actually focuses on medical mistakes. And, I did that deliberately. It's not necessarily the biggest category of cases in the system, but it's easy for anyone to understand how this can happen. A child can take a fall. The parent may or may not have seen it, probably often doesn't see it. Doesn't know what's wrong with the child. The child can have a fracture. The child can have a head injury, often from a fall or from something else. And a family takes the child to the emergency room, and suddenly they find fractures, maybe one, maybe more than one. And now the hotline gets called, especially if nobody knows what happened. If you say, oh, I saw the child fall and it was happened this way, well, maybe it won't. They wouldn't be called. But oftentimes the parent genuinely doesn't know what happened. And immediately there'll be a hotline call. People who have been near the child will be put under suspicion. And the child is reasonably likely to be taken into foster care or placed with some relatives who have to come in from out of town if they were watching the kid before, then they're under suspicion because they could have done something. And so we have the system, and then the system will trust certain doctors to give an opinion as to whether it's abuse. And those doctors are child abuse pediatricians, ordinarily. And they're not orthopedists, they're not neuroradiologists or neurosurgeons, but they're giving opinions about how fractures happened and how head injuries happened. And oftentimes they will give an opinion that something's likely abuse. They don't say by who. They can't say by who. And the child will go into the system, and there will be a court case. Then the parent is really on the defensive. You know, they went to the healthcare system looking for answers, and they didn't get answers. They got an accusation, and they got their kids taken. And then they're kind of stuck because they need to find, they need to prove their innocence at that point. We do have a stacked system. Instead of requiring the system to really have proof of what they did, we're asking them to prove, you know, that it's something they that they didn't do it.
And how do you prove you didn't do something when you know when you don't know who did do something?
That's right. That is the situation we've put a lot of parents into, and we haven't given them the resources to fight back. So this is where the, it's so important to have a lawyer who knows something about how to represent people. And that's, you know, part of the argument in my book is that we have to really much more adequately support lawyers doing this work. I mean, we shouldn't, you know, through my whole career, I've been a little bit vilified for defending parents. You know, I've been, you know, attacked for it. Well, that's starting to change. I'm happy it's changing. But we need to realize how important this is, this work of defending parents and defending families, because that's children, you know, will go in, as the caller suggested, your first caller. You know, the kids do not do well necessarily when they're taken from their parents. And it's, you know, it's a life-changing experience. Even if it's a short removal, it's life-changing for children.
Oh, absolutely. And just the whole notion of, here's your stuff, it's in your plastic trash bag, now you're, mm-hmm. you're going over here to stay.
Exactly. How traumatic is that?
Okay. I want to take it a step further, though, if you get any thoughts that you have. And that's when the child is thought to be a victim of sexual abuse. How does the system work there?
It's the system is extremely responsive. Fortunately, the numbers on sexual abuse have been going down, which is good news. But the system will, you know, what I said about medical cases, it's even in a way more so for sexual cases. I mean, if there's even a hint of sexual touching, and it can be based on really a mistaken understanding by the child, unfortunately. Obviously sexual abuse is very real, and it is very devastating to the victim. No doubt about that. But a lot of times there are cases, I've had some ridiculous cases where statements by very young children to teachers in classes where they're talking about good touch, okay, because now there's a lot of discussion in schools about what's a good touch, what's a bad touch. Children can get this wrong a lot. They can think that something was a bad touch. It wasn't a bad touch. I had one case where the child had thrown up on herself, and the uncle cleaned her up from it and changed her, you know, washed her up, cleaned her up. And she, you know, the little girl called that a bad touch. And he was arrested. I mean, we finally got to the bottom of it, and he was exonerated. It was, and in that particular case, it caused a long time rift in the family, because, you know, the mother, you know, hears the child says that her uncle touched her, and she believed, you know, that she wanted to believe the child. And so, and parents are encouraged to, you know, always believe your child. Well, it's not always true. Sexual abuse cases are really, to me, they're the hardest cases to know what's actually happened and make the right decision. But kind of a rule of thumb that I had is, I mean, to really dig into it and see what the child is actually saying and how much, and try to see, are the details that the child's giving consistent? I mean, because it's hard to know what to expect of a young child, you know, but fortunately, really, pedophilia with really young children is rare. It is rare. I think it's another example where we think it's so prevalent. But now another category is really, you know, older kids, you know, who are, and there's a lot of problems with like Romeo and Juliet type cases where, you know, kids, a 17-year-old gets blamed for sexual abuse of a 15-year-old. Well, it was probably, you know, consensual relationship, maybe.
Maybe, maybe not.
Exactly.
And you can never know, because unfortunately.
Yeah, but should we be, should we be prosecuting the 17-year-old for what he believed was a consensual relationship, and or blaming the parents, or taking, you know, one of these children out of the home? I mean, these are very challenging cases.
Well, but there's a concept, as I understand it in law, called criminal intent. And you talk about...
Exactly. Exactly. I agree with you. Criminal intent. Is there in these cases? Okay. Is it? I mean, is a lot of these sexual cases involve... You know, if there's violence, of course, that's a different matter. But if it's a, you know, hookup that, you know, the girl's embarrassed to tell her parents, so, you know, when she finds out, she makes it seem like she didn't consent.
How do you want people to use your book, Diane?
So I want people to use my book to really understand how this system is working. I mean, that's the intent, really, is to explain it, to examine it, to tell stories of families who've been through it. One of the problems is that people feel so alone if they're subject to a child protection of experience. So the book, I think, can help people understand, you know what they're up against. There are some resources in the book. We have a 50-state system and plus territories in the District of Columbia, so each state has a little bit different system. I'm aware that in Philadelphia there is the Community Legal Services Program has a hotline for people who are dealing with a child protection investigation. So I would say the main purpose is to educate. But then, beyond that, it is to advocate, because I do think we have gone too far in the direction of overloading our system with hotline calls and no solutions in many, many, many cases.
And ultimately, the decision gets made by a judge, though, doesn't it?
No.
No?
I wish it were. I wish it were the case. But we have what's called child abuse registers, and you can get your name into a child abuse register without ever seeing a judge, and it can ruin your career. It can be done on the say-so of a child protection team.
So in other words, if a complaint is made against you and you're innocent, but it stays in the registry for how long? Forever?
Well, it's different in different states. I'm not sure how long it is in Pennsylvania or your surrounding areas. A long time. I mean, it can be in some states for life. In other states, it's 50 years. In other, for other things, it's 10. I mean, so I can't generalize, but 10 years is a long time to be
Absolutely.
On a register for something you didn't do.
Absolutely.
Now,
but judges, though, make the ultimate decision if a child is to be taken from the home and kept from the
ultimately,
home.
Ultimately, that's true, except that for a long time I've worked on, and in Pennsylvania there have been a lot of so-called informal removals or agreements that aren't really agreements where children are separated and they never see a judge. So, yes, in theory, if they take your child and put the child in a foster home, you're supposed to see a judge pretty quickly. But there are also different ways around that, and states have been using them to say, well, you know, don't you want to agree to separate from your child? We're going to take your kid if you don't agree. So people always agree when they hear that, and then they don't go to any judge at all.
It amazes me, though, that on one hand, we're trying to protect children, but on the other hand, are we really?
Exactly. How is this protecting children? How is this system protecting children? And which children? I mean, we have some paradigm idea of the beaten or the starved child that, you know, we need to rescue. You know, and maybe there are a few of those kids. There were, you know, reportedly 1,600 kids who died in the same year that there were 7.4 million kids called to hotlines. Now, if you drill down on the death cases, even some of those were accidental deaths, I'm sure. So, yeah. You're right. It's what is it protecting children, this system that we have? Shouldn't we just try to focus on the kids that are in serious danger and really need to be taken from their families?
Are you satisfied with the training lawyers and judges and social workers get?
Not at all. Not at all. I'm not at all satisfied, I think. I mean, really, we're just beginning to understand the importance of, you know, protecting families and really enforcing the rights that families have to be protected, and making sure that judges, you know, not only understand the law but understand the consequences of their decisions. I mean, and this whole child welfare system, I mean, one of my pet peeves is that people generally, the public is has a better understanding of the criminal justice system. It may be because of all the TV, and maybe it's a false understanding in some ways too. But there's a sort of sensitivity built up that, you know, when you have the police an encounter with the police, it's time to get a lawyer, right? And the lawyers, you know, you expect certain things from the lawyers, and there's certain rights that you have that have been decided, you know, that you have. But that's not true when the person who's coming out to your house is a child protection investigator. You don't necessarily make, or a social worker, don't necessarily make the same assumption. And that is carried out, that same thing, problem is really in a way throughout the system. It's oftentimes treated as a stepchild system in the law, and yet it's a huge system. So I think we have a lot of ways to go. Now, the American Bar Association has really stepped up and has developed the training and the support and the resources, some of the resources, although it's really an under-resourced project too. In some ways, it doesn't have a huge budget, you know, to train attorneys all over the place. But we do have a very strong national network of attorneys, and it's getting stronger every year. And that's a good thing.
And I'd like to say thank you to Diane Redleaf, her new book, They Took the Kids Last Night, how the Child Protective Protection System puts families at risk. Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
It's been my pleasure, and it's been another edition of Conversation here on 94 WIP All Sports Radio. Before we go, a couple of things need to be talked about. One is today, 4 o'clock, at there's going to be a performance of The Messiah at a church up in there in Germantown. That church being, let me find it here, folks. That church being First Presbyterian of Germantown. 4 p.m. right there on Chelton Avenue, not too far from Germantown Avenue. Go check it out. If you need an antidote to the Christmas crazies, The Messiah by Handel, being sung at First Presbyterian Church of Germantown, is a good antidote to the Christmas crazies. Also, we say goodbye to George Herbert Walker Bush, 41st President of the United States. Whether you agreed with his politics, I think this was a good man who did his best, and for that, we owe him our gratitude. Stay tuned for WIP Sunday. If you can't, nothing left to say, but see you soon. Good morning, and the conversation continues here on 94 WIP All Sports Radio as we ease on into WIP Sunday, and a rainy WIP Sunday it promises to be. So no matter where you go, take an umbrella and take 94 WIP with you. Always good conversation, no matter what the issue or topic. And when we come back in just a moment, Felicia Kornbluth, she's been here before and she's with us again. She's one of the co-authors of the new book, Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform in Feminist Perspective. Feminism, Welfare, Poverty, and a whole lot more coming up here on 94 WIP. My name's Peter Solomon, more in just a bit. And we're back and we're talking welfare, poverty, and women from a feminist perspective. So let's say good morning to Felicia Kornbluth, one of the authors of the new book, Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform in a Feminist Perspective. Good morning, Felicia.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. When you give something a feminist perspective, what are we doing?
What we're doing is we're looking particularly at the range of gender in this particular bit of public policy. And we don't just mean talking about women, although we're really interested in what happened to women and the kinds of assumptions about women that went into making this law. We're also interested in men and how stereotypes about what it means to be a good man or a good father or a good husband, those kinds of stereotypes, I think were also manipulated and kind of twisted, and they created a policy that's really not been good for low-income men either. So I think the feminist perspective takes it on both ends, in a sense. And we look at what's happened to women and men, but in a way that pays attention to how those particular sexist or gender stereotypes actually wound up informing public policy and are still informing the policy today.
Now, is there a stereotype that you can describe for us of women on welfare?
There's an old stereotype about women on welfare, and it may just be a kind of replay of stereotypes that we've had for a really long time, you know, at least since the end of slavery in the 19th century. There are these ideas that people who used to be enslaved and who then were emancipated were not working hard enough, that, you know, something about the money they earned was illegitimate, or if they weren't earning, you know, if women were home taking care of their own children instead of taking care of somebody else's children and somebody else's house, that there was something illegitimate or wrong or even immoral about that. And then fast forward into the 20th century, the welfare program, the program that provides some assistance to mothers and children in particular, that program got a worse and worse and worse reputation. In the course of the 20th century, it was pretty uncontroversial when the program was created in the 1930s under President Roosevelt. And then if you look later and later in the 20th century into our own time, it just got a worse and worse reputation. And it was kind of that same idea that if we were helping women raise their own kids, that there was something wrong there, there's something immoral, there's something wrong with the women, that they're not working hard enough, they're lazy, they're something like that. And it's kind of crazy. I actually was just hanging out with a researcher friend of mine who said that we can look at the data and definitively we know that black women work harder than anybody else in our whole labor market and our whole society. Black women tend to have longer hours, and many, many of them work two jobs, you know, but the myth endures, the stereotype endures, that these are women who are stereotyped as being non-white and stereotyped as being bad mothers and stereotyped as being lazy or not working hard enough. And that's been kicking around for a long time.
Yep. I remember back in Stone Age when I was a kid, the stereotype of the welfare mother was the welfare queen, driving a Cadillac, dripping in gold jewelry, sitting at home on the couch watching Oprah, and eating potato chips and pork rinds.
Yeah, that's the old story. I found some evidence in the course of working on this book. You know, we wanted to talk about the origins of this law, the modern welfare reform law, which was passed in 1996. And so we went back and looked earlier in the 20th century, and you see those kinds of stereotypes showing up very, very early. There was the New York Times lampooned what they called a woman in mink who was receiving public assistance sometime in the 1940s. You know, there are not very many women in mink who are receiving public assistance. Maybe there was one. I'm not even sure I'm convinced that there ever was one. But people fasten on that idea, and it's kind of used, this extreme example is used to call into question the whole idea that we could, you know, use the government to support women and children, to support all of us when we get into a really bad financial circumstance.
And that's obviously not the case.
No, I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with us saying as a society that we're going to band together and we're going to pay our taxes, and then there's certain predictable situations that people can get into where they're going to be in financial distress or financial need. So if you're unemployed, if you're disabled, if you're ill, if you're taking care of someone who's disabled or ill, if you're raising very young children, I mean, we can go back to like the 17th century. We can go back to the time even before there was a United States. And if you look at what's happening in the little New England towns, people who have young children, women who are raising young children, often are asking the town for assistance because their husband dies, or, you know, they have a child with a man who runs off and doesn't marry them, or, you know, he goes off to war maybe and gets injured, or, you know, all kinds of situations happen, and it's actually kind of a predictable thing. And I think as a society, we're just really, really ambivalent about it. We kind of want to help people. We kind of understand that it's just normal for people to need help. But on the other hand, it makes us so, so uncomfortable.
Why do you think that is?
I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I think people talk about an old American Protestant work ethic or American work ethic. I think maybe there's something there, but it's especially strong if people can feel like, well, the folks in my group don't need the help. It's only the folks in some other group over there that is identified by race or by geography. It's only the folks in the inner city or something like that. You know, but the reality is that many of us get into those kinds of situations, and we all are in some, you know, some phase of life at some time when we're not able to entirely earn our own way, and we need help from others. And I don't know. I think we could be much more consistent about just understanding that. Maybe it's just because, you know, we're also all afraid of being dependent ourselves, you know, being physically dependent. People are terrified of becoming disabled or sick or something, and I understand that. And we're terrified of being poor. You know, it's so shaming in our culture. So I think we kind of drive away the people who are poor. You know, we want to push them out of sight and out of mind, because it's such a terrifying thing in our culture.
Mm. Okay. Where did it go wrong in terms of a law that was passed with good intentions getting twisted?
Well, we call this book Ensuring Poverty because I think our idea is, as a community, as a culture, is that we have these programs, and what they're supposed to do is reduce poverty or eliminate poverty. And what we see is that particularly the changes that happened in the 1990s through a collaboration between the Republican Congress and President Bill Clinton, Democratic president, the policy that they created together is not a policy that alleviates poverty. It's a policy that really ensures poverty, especially for women and children. And what went wrong, I think, is that the policy, it wasn't really created to eliminate poverty. If you look at the actual text of the law, which we did very closely, and the whole first chapter of the book is just a reading of the law itself, it's built on a set of findings or assumptions. And many, many pieces of federal law have this. It's a kind of rationale for why we need this law. And they offer a bunch of evidence that's very questionable evidence. And they lay out the rationale for the law, which is all about improving people's marriages and making sure that people don't have children out of wedlock or that they don't have children when they're too young or something like that. It's not really about reducing poverty. It's much more about being involved in people's romantic lives, their sexual lives, and then also about reducing the number of people who are receiving the benefit. So that becomes the metric that everybody looks at, is how many people are getting this benefit, the program that is now called Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, which was created in 1996. So that becomes the thing, like, are there a lot of people getting it, or are there a few people getting it? And success is defined as a few people getting the program. Success is not defined as, have we reduced people's poverty? Have we created opportunities or helped people find opportunities in the labor market? Have we helped the kids thrive in school? You know, it's all about reducing the caseload and also kind of fiddling around with whether or not people are married. And that is not really, if you don't try and end poverty, then most likely you're not going to end poverty. What they tried to do is reduce the numbers of people getting the benefit, and that they did succeed at doing, in part because people got jobs, although a lot of those people who got jobs got really low-wage jobs and still needed, you know, to receive health care through Medicaid and still needed food stamp assistance in some cases. You know, people still needed help. And then some people, you know, stopped getting this benefit, and they did really, really badly. And it has not been a success in any way, but, you know, they're still counted as people who aren't getting the benefit because they were just sort of pushed off the the roles, pushed off of getting public assistance without any real supportive services or without really a plan for how people were going to succeed.
What was up with the Democratic president? Because this kind of change seems to me to have been inconsistent with core Democratic principles.
Yeah, that's what we thought at the time in the 1990s. I lobbied with a group of other women researchers and writers. We went to Congress and mostly talked to women in the House of Representatives and the Senate. And we were making that argument that we were trying to tell people, just stand up and be a Democrat if you are a Democrat, you know, and that what that means is standing up for the programs were created in the 1930s by Franklin Roosevelt and his coalition. Clinton didn't see it that way, and I don't know if people remember, but I think there was a real fear that was driving the Democratic Party in the 1990s, and it's probably still there. I think there's maybe one wing of the debate right now that's very similar, and what they saw is that they had been losing, especially they had been losing presidential races. And then in 1994, they lost both houses of Congress for the first time in two generations. That was very scary. And so Clinton thought that his own survival, his political survival, and I believe that he thought the survival of the party relied on taking a hard turn to the right and giving the Republicans much of what they wanted. The language they used was triangulation. And what they meant by that was it was like three points of a triangle, and there were traditional Democrats, that was one point, and then there were Republicans who were becoming this very hardened conservative Republican Party, and then they wanted, the Clinton people wanted to be a new point on the triangle, a third point on the triangle that wasn't traditional Democrat and wasn't conservative Republican, but was somehow splitting the difference, or, you know, eking out a new rebranding, if you will, of the Democratic Party by not doing the things that people would expect or predict the Democrats to do. So what that meant for them was basically that they wrote off a group of people and sort of decided that it was okay to throw all this negative rhetoric and these very, very harsh cuts in the programs, in the support programs, for this one particular group of people who had become so stigmatized, this group of low-income moms and kids who were thought to be mostly non-white and who were thought to be not working. So the Clinton people, it was sort of like throwing something off the boat because they were afraid the boat would sink. And they threw this group of people overboard, and they thought that that would make the rest of the boat float. And from my perspective, that's kind of an immoral way to do it, but it also was very, very politically counterproductive and has come back to haunt the Democrats over and over again, because Republicans and conservatives just keep on going back to what we call the welfare reform playbook, and they just keep saying, oh, now that we've reformed welfare, let's go reform something else. Let's go reform the Medicaid program, which, you know, provides health care for low-income people. Thousands and thousands of people rely on that kind of health care. And it's become really dangerous, you know, everywhere in our domestic politics. So I think that's the story.
People really have forgotten Bill Clinton's role in all of this, haven't they?
I think they have. And Bill Clinton has said, I mean, since he took these actions and his White House decided that they were going to get on board with this very conservative policy, they tried to take that lemon and turn it into lemonade. And so for years afterward, they said, what a great success. You know, and on the 10th anniversary of that law, so that was 2006, Bill Clinton published an op-ed in the New York Times where he just trumpeted the success of that program and said, oh, isn't it great? And this is a model for bipartisanship. And I noticed, you know, there were lots of other people who did that too. Barbara Mikulski, who recently retired, who was a Democratic senator from Maryland, when she retired, she talked about her ability to be bipartisan, and she took out the story of welfare reform from the drawer and polished it off and said, this is a great moment of bipartisanship when we got together with the Republicans. And even if the Democrats who got in line with that can't claim that the program did great things for poor people, they make this other kind of argument, that it was a good example of public policy making because they worked with the Republicans to do something very dramatic. So I think it's both there and not there for the Democrats. In 2016, when Hillary Clinton was running in the Democratic primary, she didn't want to talk about this issue, but she did take some moves toward reexamining some of the policies that they took in the 1990s during that earlier, much more conservative period. And I'm hopeful that moving forward, that people who identify as Democrats or identify as progressive will be willing to go back and look at that and say, look, we made a mistake. You know, we gave too much in that period. We gave too much to Republicans on issues of crime and punishment. We gave too much to Republicans on issues of immigration, because they were pretty bad on that issue too. Not as bad as Trump, but, you know, but there's a lot, it was a lot of anti-immigrant rhetoric coming from the Dems in the 1990s, and then there was this welfare reform, which was just full of negative stereotypes and assumptions about poor people, about non-white people, about people who aren't working full-time, about women, about moms, And, you know, I think it's time. I think it's time to unearth that and tell a new story.
And you're listening to WIP Sunday here on 94 WIP All Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning, Felicia Kornbluth, co-author of Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform in a Feminist Perspective. Felicia, I need to run a few commercials, so stay with me. We'll be back in just a bit. And we're back. We're talking women, poverty, feminism, and a whole lot more with author Felicia Kornbluth as in her new book, Ensuring Poverty. Felicia?
Hi. Glad to be back.
Yay, we're back. Bill Clinton sent the whole argument south in a way that wasn't very helpful to women with kids, because how's a woman supposed to get out of poverty if she's got a young kid, very often under six, and has to support that child, feed herself, and go to work?
Yeah, I think one of the things that happened in the 1990s, I shouldn't laugh about it, but, you know, I think everybody who's raising kids is stressed out, right? And people, we know that women, especially married women, especially women with young children, have just been working more and more and more since the 1960s. And that's not feminism's fault, but that's often associated with this era of feminism. And something that's happened along the way is that I think people have gotten used to being completely stressed out and of having this kind of tension between family needs and needs to be in the workforce. And I think that at a level of policy, we've just kind of given up on the idea that we could help people, you know, and really smooth out some of the edges in people's family lives. So that comes out especially when we're making policy for poor people. And I think there has been since the 1990s a kind of hard edge and a sense that, like, well, everybody else's family is completely stressed out and, you know, parenting is, you know, kind of a nightmare for many people. So, you know, why should it be any easier for people who are low income? And I think the only way that we can bring that back around is to say, actually, for all families, you know, we could do better, and we could be much more realistic about what it requires for any parent, you know, to be raising a young child. And, you know, and by the way, also, people have all kinds of other caregiving responsibilities, whether it's to your, you know, your parents who are older, or a family member who has an illness or a disability or something like that, you know. And I just think we've gotten away from honoring that, you know, and respecting that work that people do for one another, inside the family or inside the community. And it comes out in a very, very stark and extreme way when we're talking about poor moms who may be, I don't know, maybe a mother who got into a relationship with a bad guy, an abusive guy, and she has to get out, you know, and maybe she doesn't have her own income, because we know that's part of the abuse scenario, that, you know, that somebody would cut you off from earning money and cut you off from friends and family and stuff like that. Like, somebody could be in a very, very desperate situation and have kids who are depending on them for their health and their safety. And there's just very little lifeline there for them today. And, yeah, I think we've become strangely ungenerous and also unrealistic about what it really means for people to raise children and to do all the other caregiving kinds of things that we actually rely on people to do in our society. So we can do much better.
Well, not only that, though, just simply having a young child, having a life, having to make money. And where is this also the time where things like a work requirement came into play, or school? How do you have a job and go to school or at the same time?
Yeah, exactly. So since the 1960s, people have been kicking around the idea of requiring people who are receiving public assistance to also work. In the 80s, there was an approach to it that worked a lot better. So under the welfare reform that was passed in 1988, people were allowed to go to school, and there were programs in community colleges all over the country, and even some in four-year schools, that really gave people kind of an off-ramp from public assistance to full-time work. What happened in 1996 was that there was a very harsh requirement that people work. After 2 years, at least, of receiving federal financial aid. And there was very little support there for how people were going to go about finding jobs, keeping jobs, et cetera. So, and the resources that had been there for education actually were cut. So in the 80s into the early 90s, there were these educational programs that were starting to be established. And some people were actually getting decent opportunities. And in 1996, they actually pulled back and gave people less of an opportunity to get education and call it work under the work requirement of the federal welfare law. And there was very little in the way of training, very little in the way of helping people search for jobs. It was much more just get them off, get them off, get them off, because that was the imperative in the law. You know, the states and localities that were implementing the law, they knew that the only thing that mattered was whether they could get people off of those welfare rolls. So that's pretty much what they did. And I think they did, as you were suggesting, they created kind of an untenable situation for a lot of people. If somebody does want to get ahead and they want to go to school, it's okay, they're going to do that, and they're going to be raising their kid somehow. There was no promise that we would be providing child care, by the way, either. So some people get child care with some government help. Some people don't. So maybe you're relying on a family member to provide that child care, and then you're also supposed to go to a job in addition that's not your on-campus work study or anything like that. You have to go to another location and do another kind of job. Maybe you have to go at 4 o'clock in the morning and make the donuts. We created situations for people that were just unrealistic and sort of impossible for people to sustain. And so, people do what's predictable, which is they drop out of school, and maybe they can keep the donut shop job or the other kind of entry-level job. But they're really, folks really don't have much of a ladder of opportunity to make decent wages, to have jobs that have real benefits, and all of that sort of stuff. And I don't know, it's kind of a punitive, angry policy that locks people in poverty instead of giving them a way out of poverty.
The system was set up to fail the people it was supposed to be helping.
Yeah, I think so. I think it was, in a way, the system seems to be set up to make people themselves feel like they failed. This is my great fear about a lot of things about America, that sometimes we make things so hard that we just count on people themselves to say, oh, it's my fault that I'm not rich. It's my fault that I didn't, do the kinds of things that Donald Trump did to make his millions or whatever. And really, most of the time, it's not our fault. There are circumstances that make it very, very difficult, especially if you're starting out in poverty, especially, if there's one point in your life where you make a bad choice, where you get involved with that guy who's abusive or violent, it's really hard to come back from there. And it's especially hard to do it on your own if you don't have strong community support and if you don't have some financial support from the government, and we know that that's not there anymore.
And it's getting worse, isn't it? We're going to get worse.
I think it might. What we see is that this is a situation that it goes along with the general economy. When the economy gets worse, then, it's kind of like a rich person might sneeze, but it's a poor person who gets pneumonia. In other words, when the economy has a downturn, people who are doing okay might suffer a little bit, but people who are at the bottom really, really suffer. So we know that's true, but we also know that there are a lot of folks who are not prospering even when the rest of the economy seems to be good. So I worry about what happens if we do have another recession, and folks have talked about this, that the the stock market is overvalued and there's going to be a major quote-unquote correction. That means possibly a recession, that, you know, companies are already not hiring that much. What happens if they really start not hiring? I think, you know, it could get much more serious for folks. And I think that, you know, the hope is that there has been a really serious conversation among progressive types in the last few years, and, you know, maybe we'll have some public policy solutions, at least at the state level, and maybe ultimately also at the national level. So I guess I would say, yes, there's a chance that it could get a lot worse, but I'm still holding out some hope that maybe that won't happen.
Does your book offer any solutions or just document the problem?
Well, the thing that we offer as a kind of hope, we're looking backwards and looking forwards. So what we're aware of is the fact that even when this policy created, this welfare reform of 1996 was created, there were a lot of people who dissented. There were a lot of people who were not on board with it, and they tended to be, you know, folks who were representing lower-income folks, representing the cities, representing non-white groups. So those legislators, even the inside Washington people, were dissenting against President Bill Clinton and against the Republican Congress and calling for a much more humane kind of policy. And when the welfare reform came up for reauthorization for the first time, and that was 2001-2002, the law was set to expire. And there was a serious debate in the early 2000s about what direction we were going to take. And ultimately, the members of the government decided to stay on this really conservative course, what we would consider an anti-mother, anti-woman kind of a course. But we still have the documents that people created in the early 2000s, and some of the people who were there are still around. So the last thing in our book is a document that was created by this network of researchers and women writers and researchers that I was part of called the Women's Committee of 100. And it was a document that was created in the early 2000s to inform that debate. And I think we could go back there. And that document is all about how we could value the work that especially mothers, but other caregivers, other parents, other people who are providing care to vulnerable members of their families or young kids, you know, how we could create a public agenda that would support them instead of making their lives harder. And so what we want is a policy that would support women who are doing caregiving work, whether they're being paid or not. So people who work in nursing homes, for example, they're doing caregiving work, and they're often very low paid, and they could definitely use, you know, the protection of unions and more consistently, and they could use the protection of government assistance to make sure that their wages are adequate and their working conditions are adequate. And then there are people who are doing caregiving work in their own homes for their kids. Then there are people who are doing child care, maybe in a family daycare situation or an institutional, you know, a larger child care. All those people are doing caregiving work. And so we created a caregiving policy agenda, which is an agenda that I still believe in very much. And it sounds a little, I guess it sounds a little pie in the sky these days, given where our politics are at. But I think it's a kind of agenda that unites many, many people who are doing that work of caring for one another, caring for people who are in need in one way or another, whether they're kids or ill or elderly or whoever. And I think it's a kind of agenda that could unite many people if we really believed that the politicians were serious about it. I think many people would rise to that call because we know how much stress there is in our families, you know, whether we're trying to hire a caregiver for our elderly parent or, you know, find a child care center for our kids or whether we're doing that work ourselves. And I think many, many, many of us could really use a government that seemed to get it, you know, that seem to understand that that's something that is causing us a lot of stress and that we need help.
Absolutely. And again, Felicia, got to run some more commercials. Be back in just a bit. The WIP time, 7:36. And we're back in into the home stretch with Felicia Kornbluth, while co-author of Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform in Feminist Perspective. My name's Peter Solomon. Felicia, it may be a naive question, but there are more poor people who were in these programs than there were people who weren't, correct?
More poor people in the programs than there were poor people who were not in the programs?
Then,
is that what you're saying?
Than people like you and me who weren't necessarily in those programs. I guess I'm asking, why didn't the poor folks band together and vote the suckers out?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Well, the problem is that, sort of by definition, these programs have been, they've been narrowed. They've been minoritized, you could say. So it becomes a smaller and smaller minority over time. Like in the 1930s, first of all, we know everybody was poor, right? At the time that the government created the New Deal under President Roosevelt, everybody was poor, so there was a much more of a sense of fellow feeling and that the government sort of couldn't get away with ignoring folks. But also, when the programs were created, they covered a much bigger range of people. Like originally there was this program, Aid to Dependent Children, and it covered all mothers who were raising young children if they were poor and if they didn't have the benefit of a partner's or a husband's support. But what happened over time is that most of the people who had been married, people who were widows, for example, they wound up getting Social Security instead. They wound up getting Social Security as survivors of men, typically, who had been getting Social Security. And that wasn't true in the beginning. It became true by an amendment to the law in the late 1930s. And so those tended to be people who had a little more political clout, and those tended to be people who were white. They were more likely to be white. They were more likely to be people who had a few more economic resources, right? So the people who were left receiving what used to be called aid to dependent children or aid to families with dependent children and then became our current day welfare program, that became a more and more vulnerable group of people, more politically vulnerable. And, you know, they did organize on their own behalf. I've written about this, too, especially in the 60s and 70s. They were strong, kind of coming off the civil rights movement. There was a movement for welfare rights, and people really pushed a serious political agenda. And even in the 90s, when President Bill Clinton started making noises about, quote-unquote, ending welfare as we know it, and people who were using those benefits were very worried, they started to organize again, and with the help of a lot of middle-class allies, the help of some social workers, the help of some legal aid lawyers who helped them bring cases and stuff, you know, there was a pushback. It was drowned out, I think, by the mainstream politics. I think media didn't pay very much attention to that pushback, and people who were close to the mainstream of politics, except for, you know, a very few, didn't really pay any attention. I remember I lobbied Congress on this issue in the 90s, and I remember going to people, like we went to Representative Patricia Schroeder from Colorado, if anybody remembers her. You know, she ran for government for president briefly and cried on the campaign trail. But anyway, that wasn't the thing she was best known for. She was a good legislator, but she was on the verge of retiring, and so she was very, very honest with us. And we went in and we said, look, we want you to fight this welfare reform. We want you to stand up for low-income mothers and children who are being stereotyped and who are going to have their resources really diminished. And she said, you know, I don't think that, you know, there's going to be any political consequence if I vote for the welfare reform. I don't think anybody is going to vote me out of office for that issue. You know, we tried to say, oh, we're feminists and we represent the feminist movement in America. And she was just like, no, you don't. Even among feminists, do people know this is happening? Do people care? You know, she really sort of called our bluff that we were only a small group of people who really were focused on this issue. and that most Americans were not. Most Americans, I think, really believed the rhetoric that was coming from the White House and coming from Congress about how this was going to be a good thing for poor people. You know, that's how they packaged it, and that's how they really marketed it to people.
Well, it seems to me today, in terms of future change, the majority of Americans, not even the majority, but the majority that put Donald Trump in office, believe, I got mine and you can starve.
Yeah, I hope that's not true. I mean, what people say is that what they want, and I think this is what we all want, we want government help to go to the people who are truly needy. And I think the problem is that some politicians are willing to manipulate that and to say, oh, yeah, yeah, we're just going to give the money to the truly needy. And I think these days there's a rhetoric of somehow we'll take the money away from the people who don't need it, and then we'll target it at the people who do need it. And that is a myth. That is not really what's happening, and it's not what's going to happen. So if, for example, they succeed at changing the Medicaid program, which is the health care program for people who are disabled and low income or people who are elderly and low income, and they impose, quote-unquote, work requirements for Medicaid, that's not going to be targeting the program on people who really need it or people who really deserve it. It's just going to be taking away health care from an awful lot of Americans. And maybe it's going to help some state governments kind of balance their books, but it's going to expose some low-income people, and I'm especially concerned about moms and kids, because there are a lot of moms and kids who need to get their health care through Medicaid. It's going to expose them to an awful lot of potential risk and bad health, you know, because they are not going to be getting health care through some other means. Medicaid is what many, many people have for health care. And so, yeah, so I think there's a kind of fancy rhetoric. Maybe people willfully believe it a little bit. Maybe people kind of want to believe it because it helps keep our taxes low or something like that. But I do think that people have been often persuaded that we could play some kind of fancy game. It's like the social policy version of a precision bombing or something like that, and the idea that we could only hit the targets that are real targets and not wind up also hitting some civilians or some schools or some hospitals. Like, it doesn't really work that way. You know, if we start cutting social programs with a big sledgehammer, a lot of people who really do need some assistance are just not going to get it. They're not going to get health care. They're not going to have the money that they and their kids need to be able to put food on the table. That's just the reality. And so I don't think that people are so indifferent, but I think people are maybe willfully deluded about it. And people sometimes some Americans at least, believe that hype.
Well, but it seems to me a lot of Americans don't believe that there but for the grace of God go I. I'm one paycheck away from welfare. I'm one paycheck away from food stamps. I'm one paycheck away from losing my house. I mean, I'm lucky enough to have several streams of income, but I had a surgery 2 years ago with a $38,000 hospital bill. And if I didn't have health insurance, I'd be living in a refrigerator box today because of that $38,000.
That's right. Yeah, it's an interesting thing. You know, the data that colleagues of mine around the country have done tell a pretty stark story. A lot of Americans don't have very much in savings. You know, and if people have an emergency, it can really throw the whole balance off. You know, it can throw your financial house completely out of whack. And yet, we don't like to believe that. We don't like to believe it about ourselves, maybe we don't put enough money away, and we also don't support the kinds of programs that would give us more of a safety net. And we don't really, we don't really believe it about other people either. We used to say this, especially in the feminist movement in the 1970s and 80s, we'd say, especially to women, that you're only one paycheck away from welfare. You're also only one divorce or one separation away from welfare. You know, many women still are not working full-time because they have these other caregiving responsibilities. And if you get into a terrible relationship, you know, with somebody who's not reliable, or if you're in a relationship with somebody who loses their job, you know, then that can also throw the whole thing over. And I think that should be a basis for sympathy, you know, that we all understand our vulnerability. And, you know, and I think it should also be a basis for us being a little urgent about this whole thing, because we could all get into trouble. I mean, I think about it in terms of Social Security, you know, and there being some real safety net there when I'm older. And I think about it in terms of disability. I could be, you know, disabled tomorrow. And what if this government succeeds at really cutting down to the bone the Medicare program, the Social Security program, our disability insurance program, et cetera? Those are all government programs. We could call all of it welfare in a way. You know, it all involves a lot of really intense government action. It's redistributive in some ways. It has, I mean, the money has to be moved around. You know, it's all a species of welfare. And, you know I need it. And I want everybody to have access to that when they're in times of real need or real vulnerability. And I think, I don't know, I think we could all be reminded of that sometimes. And I think that in a lot of ways we are compassionate people. We just need to be brought back to our better selves a little bit sometimes.
Wonderful words from Felicia Kornbluth, co-author of Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform, and Feminist Perspective. Thank you, Felicia.
Thank you.
And it's been another edition of WIP Sunday. Stay tuned for Sports Talk with Sunny Hill. If you can't, nothing left to say, but see you soon.